90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Welcome to Talk Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our guest is Dr. Doug Burgess, Director of Recovery Health Services Program at Truman Medical Center. Good morning, Dr. Burgess, and welcome to Talk Conversations.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I'm originally a lifelong Missourian. Grew up in St. Louis and did training in psychiatry and got additional training in addiction psychiatry. I moved to the Kansas City area about 7 years ago, and I currently work at Truman Medical Centers as the medical director for outpatient psychiatric services, where I see patients with substance use disorders and also teach medical students and residents at University of Missouri, Kansas City.
What led you to work in Recovery Health Services Program at Truman Medical Center?
Well, the honest answer is my wife. When I moved to the area, I was not real familiar with the medical community here, and I had drug her around for about 9 years when I was doing my training. So it was her turn to pick where we lived, and she told me about Truman Medical Center, and it kind of fit with my passion, which is serving an underserved community, and interviewed there, and they had a position open, so that's kind of how I ended up here.
So, and all else fails, you will blame it on your wife, if that's what you're trying to say.
Yes, always.
We hear a lot in the news about opioids. What exactly are opioids, Dr. Burgess?
So opioids, in the simplest terms, are pain medications, and they're a specific type of pain medicine that works on your brain and your nervous system. They require a prescription, and they can be really useful in controlling some pain conditions.
We hear the term opioids, but we're not attaching a medication to that term opioids. What are some of the common medicines that are opioids that people may not know are opioids?
So probably most people have probably heard of Percocet, Vicodin, oxycodone, medications like that. When you talk about medicines that may contain opioids that people may not be aware of, Tylenol number 3 and some prescription cough medicines can contain codeine as well. So those are the ones that I think people might be unaware of that contain opioids.
Are opioids harmful for people to take them, or is it something that is a short-term type of medication that's something built for a long-term?
That's a tough question. I would say, like anything, there are certainly valid reasons to use opioids. They will continue to have a useful purpose in medicine and in controlling acute pain conditions and some chronic pain conditions. But like anything, if they're taken incorrectly or taken for too long a period of time, in some cases, they can be problematic and have consequences.
How addictive are opioids? It's been estimated that the number of people who are addicted worldwide is between 26 and 36 million people.
Well, the term, it's a little complicated, because when you talk about addiction, oftentimes people are talking about becoming physically dependent on the medication. And certainly that is a risk with opioids. Even if they're taken exactly as prescribed, our brains and our nervous systems change over time, and we become physically dependent, where we need the medication in order to not experience withdrawal symptoms. Just because you have those, just because you're physically dependent on a medication, doesn't necessarily mean you have an addiction. When people talk about addiction, what they're oftentimes referring to is a loss of control over use of the medication. And so, you know, certainly anybody who takes an opioid for a long enough period of time, it's almost universal that they will develop some level of physical dependence on the medication. Now, the rates of addiction are a little bit tougher to determine, but certainly they are very addictive and can be addictive.
How quickly can a person become addicted to an opioid?
A lot of this is going to be variable depending on the person's experience. So I use my example with opioids. I had a root canal done about a year ago, and I was prescribed by my dentist. I was prescribed opioids following that procedure. I took one pill. I felt sick. I felt groggy. I was throwing up. I don't have the genetic makeup. I don't have the response to opioids that I'm likely to ever develop an opioid use disorder. For other people, I talk to them, the patients that I treat in clinic, they tell me that the first time they take opioids, they felt alive. It gave them energy. They felt euphoric. It made them forget their problems, their stress, all of these things. And so for that group of people, I think they can become addictive very quickly, and people can use them recreationally, and then over time you get into that situation where they've lost control of their use.
Many people describe opioids every day. What are some of the side effects that they should be looking for if they're taking opioids?
So if you're taking opioids as prescribed, the most common side effects that you're going to experience with them are constipation, sedation. Certainly there's risk of, you know, slowing reflexes if you're driving a car or operating heavy machinery. Some of the more serious side effects, of course, the most serious side effect is if someone is taking, if they accidentally take too much of the medication, or if they combine them with other medications which are sedating, they can get they can experience respiratory sedation, so they stop breathing and die. And that's certainly the one that we're most concerned with, and the one that we hear about all the time.
Studies have shown that oxycodone is the most widely used recreational opioid in America. Why is that?
The primary reason that any substance is going to be more addictive is going to be the onset of action. So how quickly after you take the substance do you get do you feel a response? Does it make people feel good? And oxycodone certainly has a quick onset, and it only lasts for, you know, the euphoria or the high that someone might experience from that may only last 3 to 4 hours. And so you get this cycle where people take the medicine, they feel good, but then 3 to 4 hours later they may be feeling bad. And so there's this compulsion then to seek out the medication again and to continue taking it more frequently and in greater quantities over time. And so that's the primary reason why that one is addictive. The other piece I would say is it's just the one that's most common. You know, all of the different opioids have some variability in terms of how long they last and what effects people will experience. But the primary reason with oxycodone is it's one of the most widely prescribed medications, so it's just more available and people are more likely to get exposed to it.
In the 1970s, oxycodone was classified as a class 2 drug, indicating a high potential for abuse and addiction. What led to doctors prescribing this powerful drug if it was already known that it could cause abuse and addiction over 40 years ago?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. But if I can kind of summarize the, I think some of the main factors that have been identified, you know, certainly in the early to mid 90s, some of the pharmaceutical companies really had an aggressive marketing campaign to get doctors to prescribe more of these medicines, and they minimized the potential risk. And I think doctors were, didn't do their own research, and they took the information from the pharmaceutical companies without questioning it, and didn't really pay attention to what their patients were experiencing, which is continued use, using higher quantities, difficult time coming off of the medications. You also started to get a lot of off-label prescriptions of the pain medicines. So I think that was one of the factors. I also think that in the age that we live in, you know, there's more pressure to see more patients, spend less time with patients, and in that kind of environment, it's a lot easier for a physician to prescribe a medication that than it is to talk with the patient and really think about, is this the best treatment for that patient?
Is oxycodone a gateway drug that people may use that can lead them to taking stronger drugs like opioids, like fentanyl, or adding drugs such as cocaine to increase the impact in the body?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about this. The potential is certainly there. If you look at people who inject heroin, over 80-85% of them started use with prescription medications, and so I don't think there's any question. Now that certainly doesn't mean that everybody who takes a prescription opioid is going to progress and begin to use heroin, but certainly if you look at where people start, it's with prescription opioids the vast majority of the time.
I know that they did such a great case in prescribing medications while doing research for the show. There was one county in West Virginia where doctors prescribed so many opioids that they broke it down per person. Each person could get 400 opioids per day. And it was like millions of pills that were issued in just 1 year. And when they were on Capitol Hill, there was only one. They brought all the drug manufacturers before Congress, and there was only one of them that apologized.
Wow.
And that was the one whose company had did all the shipping to that particular area. But they weren't. The drug manufacturers were saying, no, we're just trying to meet a demand for a product. But, you know, when they're prescribing that product like candy, it's easy for people to get hooked. And in that case, they put profits over people.
Yeah, I think you're right on with that, and we see a similar thing in Missouri, where you know the statistics show that there are more prescriptions of opioids than there are men, women, and child living in the state, and so I think that's been the biggest reason for the explosion is just you're casting a wide net. It's not that people today are more likely to develop opioid use disorder than they were 40, 50, 60 years ago. It's just that there's everybody who does have that risk of developing an opioid use disorder gets exposed to an opioid because they're so prevalent in society and they've been prescribed so much.
Opioids are used in many cases to treat those who are afflicted with chronic pain. But what happens when that person begins to say they think they're in more pain than what they are? They begin to take more medication than what the doctor prescribes.
Yeah, so you bring up the issue of pain, and I think it's important when we talk about pain that we kind of unpack what we're talking about there. You know, some people, when they talk about pain, they have physical pain. You know, it might be chronic back pain. It might be, you know, nerve pain. So there's different types of physical pain. But the other thing we know is that oftentimes when people are talking about pain, it's not as clear-cut as that. And so they could be talking about mental pain, anxiety. They could be talking about depression. We know that people who are anxious, who are depressed, who have ongoing trauma in their lives, that they're in abusive relationships or there's aspects of their life that they're not safe or not healthy, we know that they're going to oftentimes experience pain in a different way, and pain may be more acute. So oftentimes people are taking opioids to treat pain that may be partially physical, but also psychological and related in their emotional health.
Okay. So does taking opioids as prescribed by your doctor, when does that go from proper medication to abuse of your medications?
So the warning signs for abuse of the medications are needing to take more of the medication than you're prescribed. Certainly using it for reasons other than it's prescribed. So anytime someone's using an opioid on the weekends because they want to go out and have a good time, that's going to be a misuse of the opioid. Diverting the medication, so sharing it with friends, sharing it with relatives, kind of deciding, well, I have this medicine left over and you've got a little bit of knee pain, try taking this. That's going to be, a risk sign for someone who's maybe at risk for misusing the medication.
How dangerous is it, as we talked about earlier, opioids being a gateway drug, specifically OxyContin, how dangerous is it for the people to mix opioids though, with, say, alcohol, other things, and not know that they're actually it's doing more damage than what they may think?
Yeah, this is a huge issue. When someone is found dead or overdosed on an opioid, and you look at what's in their system, it's frequently the case that they're combining multiple opioids. They may also be using medications known as benzodiazepines, which are common ones are like Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, and those medication and alcohol as well. All of those work on our brainstem and cause people to breathe less. And it's not a situation where you get 1 + 1 = 2. It's a situation where you get 1 + 1 = 4. So they work together to really amplify the suppression of people's breathing.
So if you have any questions for Dr. Burgess on opioids or opioid abuse, give us a call on our studio line, 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. In the 1980s, there was a crack epidemic. What is the huge difference in between the crack epidemic and the opioid epidemic?
I think there's a lot of parallels. Part of the reason we hear so much about the opioid epidemic today, and I have full disclosure, I'm 37 years old, so I wasn't practicing during the late 80s when the cocaine and crack epidemic was at its peak, but. I do know that at the peak of the cocaine and crack epidemic, you had about 3,000 deaths per year. What we're seeing with the opioid epidemic is, similar numbers of people becoming addicted to opioids, but we're seeing the most recent data is around 65,000 people per year that are dying. If trends continue over the next 5 to 6 years, just in the 21st century, we're going to be approaching 1 million people who have died from opioids. So I think in terms of the volume of people dying from the drug, I think that that's one of the big differences.
And to add to that, every day in America, 115 people die from opioid abuse.
Yeah.
So you're talking 800 people per week. 3,200 people per month are dying from opioid abuse.
Yeah, and I've seen those numbers vary from 115, which is one that's commonly cited, all the way up to 160 or 175 people per day. And I was at a conference about 5 or 6 months ago, and one of the speakers put it in a way that really brought it home to me. It's like we're in the United States. It's like there's a plane crash every single day. 175 people, and imagine turning on the news and reading about another plane crash every single day. So it really kind of puts that number into perspective, and it's a scary number.
So as we were talking about crack, does crack and cocaine work in the same way in a person's body as the opioids do?
No, they're completely different. Cocaine is a stimulant, whereas opioids are a suppressant, respiratory. They cause people to stop breathing. Cocaine produces euphoria, similar to opioids, but it works by there's a specific neurotransmitter in our brain called dopamine, and it works by increasing dopamine levels to thousands of times the normal level. Little bit of dopamine is good. If you get some good barbecue and it tastes good, you get a little bit of dopamine release. Cocaine works on that system and causes a large amount of dopamine to be released, and that causes people to feel good and feel high. But it can also cause really bad things like elevated blood pressure, heart attacks, strokes, psychosis, where people may hear things or see things that aren't really there, and certainly impulsivity and making decisions that people wouldn't make if they weren't under the influence of cocaine.
So when we start to talk about the cocaine crack mixture, why is that so addictive?
Again, with cocaine, it's going to be how quickly the onset of action. So when you use cocaine, depending on how you use the cocaine, whether it's smoked or inhaled or injected, you're talking about an intense rush that occurs within a matter of a few minutes of taking the drug. And then depending on how the cocaine is used and how long you've used cocaine for, that high and that euphoria tends to last from anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes up to a couple of hours. But then people are, crashing after that. They feel low energy. They can feel depressed. And that triggers then cravings to use more of the cocaine. So that quick onset, quick offset again is going to be one of those the reasons why cocaine is so addictive.
We have a caller, Melissa. Can you tell us what part of Kansas City you're calling from? What your question is for Dr. Burgess?
I'm calling from Raytown, actually.
Okay, go ahead. What's your question for Dr. Burgess?
Well, I probably know the answer to my question, but I do have a friend who's about 72 or 3 probably, and I know for at least a year he's been taking hydrocodone and also benzodiazepine of some sort. And I know that he's moved recently from Dallas to California, meaning he now has a new doctor, and I know he's now seeing a psychiatrist for medication for depression. So he tells me he has a team of doctors, meaning a physician and a psychiatrist, so I assume that they're looking more closely at his medication. So now he's taking opioids and a benzodiazepine and an antidepressant. So it worries me, but surely they know what they're doing. I hear what you're saying. It seems to me that you're trying to make a distinction between dependency and a true addiction for recreational purposes, but
yeah, Melissa, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So what do you think about that?
Well, Melissa, I can't comment specifically on one case. Certainly there are legitimate reasons that patients need to be prescribed benzodiazepines and prescription pain medications, and so you do have to rely on the treating physicians and the treating team. But one of the best things that I think has come out of all of the attention around the opioid use disorder is the questions that you're asking. I think it's important as patients and consumers of healthcare to educate ourselves on the potential risks and not just trust that our doctors are all communicating. You mentioned there's a team of doctors, and that is a great approach when it works well and people are talking. But oftentimes, those teams are siloed, and one physician may not know what the other physician is doing. And so making sure that you bring a complete list of all your medications when you go to see the doctor, and then have family members, if they notice, if they have concerns about over-sedation, frequent falls, sleeping a lot, those sorts of things can be warning signs that maybe there is a combination of medications that needs to be looked at and addressed.
Thank you for your question, Melissa. Well, go ahead.
Yes, I'm comforted by the fact that these two doctors are in the same office, so that hopefully means they're talking to each other, and he is being monitored pretty closely, having lost his partner recently. But that's bring up a good point. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we lost a caller. John, can you give us a call back? So that's one of the things she was talking about. People are now doctor shopping. You know, how do we in Missouri stop people doctor shopping? You said earlier that more opioids were prescribed than there were people in the city, and it's because people adopt doctor shopping. How do we address that?
Well, yeah, so doctor shopping is part of the problem, and there are some programs out there, like Missouri does. You know, I know the governor is working on a statewide prescription drug monitoring program. We do have a prescription drug monitoring program here in Jackson County and other counties in the area that covers over 80% of the pharmacies and patients in the state of Missouri. So that has helped. You know, when you look at the numbers of people that are getting the medications from multiple doctors, you're really talking at about less than 10% of the problem. The bigger issue is just that everybody who goes to a dentist or a physician or, another health primary care doctor, that there's just a lot of the opiates prescribed, and then we hang on to them for months and years, and they sit in our medicine cabinet, and, you know, kids or family members who may be struggling with an opioid use disorder have access to those from friends or relatives, either buying them or stealing them.
We have a caller. John, can you tell us your name? Can you tell us what part of Kansas City you're calling from?
And what's your question? I'm calling up in Liberty.
Sure. What's your question?
So you all are touching on it a little bit, but whenever I had a kidney stone a couple of years ago, the first doctor I went to prescribed me 20 Oxycontin, and then they suggested I go see a specialist, and the specialist also actually prescribed me 20, so I had two scripts at the same time. And then after my surgery, I actually got a call back from one of the nurses asking if I needed to re-up my script, and I'm like the doctor. I was cutting the pills in half. I like barely needed any in order to really feel that. So my question was about why are the doctors' computers not talking to each other in terms of their database that's tracking these people or all of the prescriptions that are going out? And you were touching on that a bit. So
actually, that's where we're going next. Thank you so much for your call, John.
Thank
you.
John, I think that there's a huge opportunity for improvement in communication, and one of the barriers is every hospital system and every doctor uses a different electronic health record system, and we have to balance linking those systems with protecting patient information, and sometimes in an effort to keep records confidential, I think that it creates barriers in communication, especially between computer systems. But there are efforts to break down those barriers. In the Kansas City area, they do have a system. It's called LACEY, Lewis and Clark Information Exchange, which links a lot of the major hospitals together so that if you come into my office at Truman Medical Center, I can log into that system and see what you've been prescribed in other places. But it's not all the hospital systems, and it's not all of the rural physicians' offices, and it doesn't encompass everything yet. So that's one thing that could certainly be done that I think would have a really positive outcome, not just with the opioid use disorder, but a number of health conditions.
Legislators in Missouri were slow in moving toward putting that database together. If they had acted faster, would we have possibly been able to slow this process in Missouri? Because doctors would have been able to see that you got 40, as Kava called in and said, he got 20 pills from this doctor, 20 pills from that doctor, and then if he maybe had a third doctor in there, now he could essentially have 60 pills in 1 month. You know, if he's taking those pills, that should be a red flag if somebody's taking that many opioids.
Yeah. Again, this idea of, personally, I am in favor of prescription drug monitoring programs, but there's a little bit of a nuance to that answer because, you know, in states that have it, you look at states like West Virginia, Ohio, that have prescription drug monitoring programs, you're still seeing some of the highest rates of overdose in the entire country. And so I think it's important that when we use that information as good as a doctor, I want to have as much information as possible. But it's important to make sure that our doctors are educated on how to use that information. Because if I find out that someone is getting multiple medications from multiple doctors, absolutely it's something that I need to address, but it needs to be addressed correctly. And the correct response isn't to suddenly discontinue all of those medications, because then you have people that maybe don't have an opioid use disorder, maybe just have a physical dependence on the medication, that suddenly they're going to be experiencing extreme withdrawal symptoms, and it may push them, because they're unable to function at work, unable to function as a parent, unable to function in the things that are important in their life, and they may be pushed to other avenues in order to get that medication. And so it's important that we're using that information correctly as a health community.
Thank you for that answer. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today we're talking opioids, but we'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. We are today on Cowtown Conversations talking about opioids. And our guest is Dr. Dirk Burgess, who's over recovery systems at Truman Medical Center. And we have a caller on the line. Our caller, John, can you tell us what your question is? And thank you for calling.
I think John was the previous caller. Okay. My name's Kurt.
I'm sorry, Kurt. Go ahead, Kurt. Kurt from NESAC. Thank you for calling. Can you tell us what your question is for Dr. Burgess?
I've got two. I was wondering what the whether the time delay variance of these painkillers play in the problem. And the other one is, I think a lot of the problem is inattentive healthcare personnel. I always recommend that when you see a doctor or a nurse, you ask them a question that they would know if they read your chart. So often, they just see you and they haven't even read any of your history. So then, again, the first one was whether the, I think John said he took OxyContins and cut them in half. And I, you know, my understanding, and I could be wrong, there could be types of OxyContin where you can cut them in half, but that disrupts the time delay and increases the dosage, and I don't know, you might want to discuss that. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, so with your first question, it's important if you're taking a medication, if you have a question, you can always clarify with the pharmacist whether or not it's a medication that can be split in half or crushed or things like that. I do think there's an idea that longer acting pain medications have a lower risk of developing, and well, I'll say this, they're less likely to produce that immediate onset, that euphoria that some people, that may be rewarding for some people, but long acting formulations are still going to produce that physical dependence if they're taken for a long period of time. So long acting medications, some of them cannot be broken in half, so it's important to clarify that with your pharmacist or doctor if that's something you're going to be doing. To your second point, the question about or the statement about asking a question to review that your physician has reviewed your chart. Yeah, I think it's always important to make sure that your physician has as much information as possible when they're working with you.
As we were talking earlier about crack was never declared a national epidemic like opioids have been. Did our lawmakers miss a critical opportunity to figure out how to combat a drug crisis that sooner or later would leave inner-city urban core areas and travel to areas where more affluent people live and continue in the mainstream America?
Well, I'd like to think that we learned something from the way we approached the cocaine use disorder or crack epidemic as a society, as lawmakers, as law enforcement officials, as a medical community. I would like to think we learned something from that. The 2000s were deemed the decade of the brain. And I think it's what our approach is today in treating substance use disorders. There's been so much advancement and increased understanding that when people have a substance use disorder, that they're not bad people, they're not necessarily criminals, they're not, they may do bad things and they may participate in some activities that are criminalized, but if you treat, and I see this every single day, I see people who come in that, you know, it's easy to judge them and judge the things that happen, but you have to check that. And what I get the advantage of, I get to see people who come in and maybe they're not doing the best job as a father or a mother, or maybe they're having problems at work or stealing or doing things that are done out of desperation. I get to see what happens when they get treated and they get better. And what I see are good mothers, good fathers, responsible citizens. They have a brain disease that is causing them to make decisions that are not in line with their values and don't define who they are as people.
So basically the crack epidemic allowed doctors to be able to see how they can actually treat people better and make sure that those treatments do work. Did it also give them opportunity to see what type of medications would be effective and why some treatments may work better than others?
Yes, unfortunately we still don't have great medications to treat cocaine use disorder itself. It's not for a lack of effort. There are lots of things that have been studied and have not necessarily borne out great results. But I do think if you look at the results of what happens when you criminalize this, what happens when you arrest people and you don't offer them treatment, you're just perpetuating the system, and I think some of that has informed the decisions that we make towards substance use in general, and we're seeing things like drug courts coming up. We're seeing things like treatment being offered in the criminal justice system, and I think that those are more effective ways to approach this problem.
Okay, so what are some of the signs and symptoms of opioid overdose?
So the most common signs and symptoms of overdose are going to be just sedation. So the person's going to be difficult to arouse. Sometimes they may start to turn pale. You may notice their lips are blue. If they're breathing, you may notice that it sounds like they're snoring or kind of a rattling sound. Inability to arouse them with, rubbing on their chest or shaking them, calling their names, those sorts of things are signs that someone has potentially had an overdose of opioids.
What should you do if you're in a situation where somebody's had a potential opioid abuse? What should a person do?
The most important thing is to call 911 immediately if someone's not responding and appears to be having trouble breathing. So that's very, very important. We have medications that if you have a family member that has an opioid use disorder, or you have a family member that is prescribed opiates for a long period of time, there's a medication called naloxone, which is its trade name is Narcan. It comes in a few different formulations, but basically it's a medication that can be given to reverse the effects of an opioid overdose, and there's been lots of information from the Surgeon General and health organizations promoting increased prescription and increased access to this medication, naloxone.
We have a caller, Jack, on line 2 from Shawnee. What's your question?
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you.
Good morning. I'm wondering, does the doctor know if marijuana was legalized? What would happen? It seems I've heard out in Colorado and places where marijuana is legalized that there's been a drop in opioid addiction. So I'd be curious as to what the doctor thinks about that. Thanks.
Thank you.
So there, I cannot comment from a medical perspective. I just don't think there's enough research right now to comment on the effects marijuana legalization may or may not have on opioid use disorder.
Okay. Dr. Burgess, are there any precautions that a person should take when they're trying to assist someone that may have overdosed on opioid?
So the main precautions that you it's really situationally you want to assure that you're safe and the patient is safe. Like if they're passed out in the middle of the street, obviously you would want to move them out of the street. I think maybe what you're getting, there's been reports and rumors about some of the more potent forms of opiates being transmitted to people who are responding to the overdose. For the most part, those are anecdotal stories that haven't really been borne out. I think anytime you're responding to someone who's overdosed, you need to make sure that you're safe. This idea that some of these more potent forms of opiates can be transmitted through the air or things like that really hasn't been borne out in reality.
You're right in front of me. Basically, you're talking about fentanyl. Dr. Burgess, we all know fentanyl is a very powerful opioid. What's the medical purpose of fentanyl?
So fentanyl is used commonly in surgery. It's also used for some cancer pains. I'm certainly not a pain medicine doctor, so my understanding of all of its uses is somewhat limited. It does have a legitimate role in the medical community for treating some pain conditions. The majority of the fentanyl that we see on the streets is being shipped into the country illegally, coming from either Mexico or China, and it's being mixed with heroin or sold on its own as a particularly potent opioid.
We have a caller on line one. Caller, can you tell us your name and what your question is for Dr. Burgess?
Yeah, this is Daryl. I was curious, with implementing new treatments and trying to make that, I guess, how do you measure success with treatments on patients that are recovering, both from the person adhering to the treatment, and then if it's going to be state-provided treatment, how do you ensure or measure success in treatment provided to addicts?
Thank you for your call, Daryl.
That's a great question, Daryl. The substance use disorders in general have been held to an unfair standard, I think, when you compare it to other chronic diseases. We see it as commonly it's seen as an all or nothing thing. If someone is either completely abstinent or they are relapsed and hopeless. The measures that we use at Recovery Health Services when we're measuring response to treatment are overall use. Has their use decreased? If they were injecting drugs, we take a harm reduction approach, because while that may not be the end-all be-all for treatment, if the person's not alive, they're never going to achieve recovery. So when you look at outcomes like connection with family, employment, housing, those sorts of things, those are other outcomes that we look at in terms of response to treatment.
As we're talking about fentanyl just a little bit, it's a newer synthetic opioid that is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine and 30 to 50 times more potent than heroin, with only 2 milligrams becoming a lethal dose. Fentanyl is pure white, odorless and colorless and flavorless, with a potency strong enough that police and first responders, as we were saying, have been rumored to have overdosed by simply coming in contact with it. But this is just a myth. In doing the research for the show, I saw a lot of stories, but there was not one substantiated claim where somebody overdosed by coming in contact with somebody who had taken fentanyl as an opioid. Fentanyl was the opioid that Prince overdosed on, so people definitely need to understand it's a very strong opioid and not something that you should take unless you have a doctor's prescription for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't show your listeners over the airways, but I do have, you know, in when I give lectures, I have a slide that shows the amount of a substance that someone needs to take in order to overdose. And when you look at a vial of heroin that would be toxic, you're talking about, you know, a pretty large quantity. When you start to get to fentanyl and even more concerning things like carfentanyl, you're just talking about a few grains of sand is enough to kill someone. And so it's easy to see how if you're mixing fentanyl and carfentanyl with heroin, if you accidentally get a few too many grains of fentanyl or carfentanyl in with the heroin, it can cause people to stop breathing and die.
Is there a link between mental health behaviors and opioid addictions?
So we know that individuals with mental health conditions like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, there are increased incidence of comorbid substance use disorders, and so certainly that's something we see every day.
If you're enjoying these great programs that are being medical programs, these would not have been possible without one person who's worked. The doctors have been great to come on, but without Leslie coming in, and Leslie Cardo, she works at Truman. She's the one that has helped me facilitate these great conversations. Forgive me, I'm struggling with a cold today, so I'm going to have to go see a doctor again myself.
We'll get you an appointment.
But these great conversations would not have been possible without her. So I want to say thank you for all the help that you've given us and helping to educate and inform the community.
Thank you very much for the privilege of bringing the Truman Providers to your show. I think it's a great opportunity to hear what they do in a long format. And there's so many of them. I kind of consider myself the Truman cheerleader. I find out what we do really well, and I love to share it. And I met Dr. Burgess a while ago and was pretty wowed by the work that he does and the staff does at Recovery Health Services. I mean, lives are truly changed, and it's really inspiring. And I'd like to say that lives are changed without judgment, if that's a fair thing to say. I feel like the patients, the clients that are being treated with the same respect that they would be if they had high blood pressure or if they had another physical, what you considered a physical ailment. So I have a lot of respect for this program. And I'd also like to just say for people who do have a dependence or an addiction, help is available. And Truman does a really nice job of working. I mean, we are Kansas City's essential hospital. So if you need help and funds are limited, there's help available. Don't let that stop you.
Truman is truly Kansas City's safety net healthcare provider, and they receive funds from the healthcare foundation tax that we all pay to help ensure that everyone, regardless of race, creed, or color, or income or ability to pay, can get service doing that. So I know there used to be, people used to think about Truman as wasn't the best place to go. Truman is cutting edge in technology, also in staff, and you will be surprised. So if you haven't been there, you know, maybe a place if you're sick or you've got somebody, you definitely look at, you know, getting an appointment. They cover every area or aspect that you can look at. You know, we were talking earlier, there was a little bit about being obesity and overweight and how that leads to all the different other situations, and we're going to have a future upcoming show to talk about obesity, which is fastly becoming another epidemic in America, and projected that within 10 years that 55% of Americans will be obese.
Yeah. I'd also like to say, if you don't mind, I'm a talker. Is it okay that you set me in front of the microphone? Is this a dangerous situation?
Go ahead.
I want to say that, you know, walk-ins, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Burgess, if you have an issue and you are ready to make that change at Recovery Health Services, the entrance is at 23rd and Campbell. And walk-ins are available? Am I correct on that? Yes.
That's correct, yeah. You can also call 816-404-5850, and we can give you directions on how to get there, where to park, and when you can come in and see us.
So can I ask one more question, Joseph? Is that okay? What if I know that I need help, and I'm really scared about what that process looks like? Can you talk just about what does it mean to walk in those doors, and what's ahead of me?
So we try to make we want to be as available as possible. We have effective treatments, and we really do not judge. We do not, we're not going to treat you any differently. I think anybody, if you live in this country, it's very hard to meet somebody who doesn't have an experience with a family member or friend who struggled with a substance use disorder. And, you know, we see people every single day who come in at the lowest point in their life, and we get to experience their successes, their improvement over time. And so we approach every person who comes in as an opportunity to help them and an opportunity to experience their success. So we're very positive and non-judging when people come in.
As we were talking a little bit earlier, go back, some people may have that substance abuse problems, and we would say mental health problems, and it leads to what's being called a dual diagnosis. Can you explain what a dual diagnosis is for our listeners?
Yeah, so basically dual diagnosis means you have a mental health issue along with a substance use issue, and we see that in the vast majority of people that we see at Recovery Health Services. The most common things are post-traumatic stress disorder, people who have been exposed to horrific things in their life. Sometimes they turn to drugs or alcohol in order to treat those things, in order to self-medicate. To be an effective treatment program, you need to address both the issues at the same time. We can't just focus on the drug use and ignore the psychological distress that people are experiencing, because without the drugs and alcohol, that will actually get worse. If you treat both of them together, the outcomes are so much better, both in terms of the people's mental health, their physical health, and their ability to stay in treatment.
As you were saying earlier, a lot of people get opioids from the doctor and they don't take them, and that allows their friends and family members to go shopping in their own medicine cabinets. What can people do, or what is the best way to dispose of unused opioids that they may have in a medicine cabinet to keep people from getting those opioid medications?
So periodically they have drug take-back programs that are publicized, and I can get that information to your show the next time they have one of those in the area. The other things that people can do at home, if you have an old laundry detergent container, you can, with some laundry detergent in it, you can put your medications in there, and it'll dissolve into the soap. Use coffee grounds as well. If you have a can, you can dump your medication into there, and those coffee grounds will absorb the medications over time.
And that's definitely, I know if you live in Raytown, Raytown Police Department has in their police in their lobby, they have a mailbox that people can go and take unused opioids. And from time to time, as you said, yes, the Kansas City Police Department does that. So it's definitely one of those things that if you don't leave unused opioids, because you allow your friends, your family members, your children, they can go shopping in their own parents' medicine cabinet instead of having to go out and find it someplace else.
Yeah, that's where over 80% of people are getting their opiates from when they start.
As we were talking about treatment, a lot of people who may be hooked on opioids don't have the ability or the funds to pay. Is there a process with Truman or maybe other medical centers where they can get those that may not have insurance but they want to get treated for substance abuse, that they can get coverage and treatment?
Yeah, so Truman Medical Centers and Recovery Health Services, we participate in a program that's part of it's known as the STR grant, or State Targeted Response. It's a federal initiative to address the opioid use disorder, and we have grant funding through that program that we are able to provide services and medications free of charge to anybody in the state of Missouri. The state of Kansas, as well, has some hospital systems that have access to funding as well. Money should not be a barrier to receiving treatment.
I would like to thank Dr. Burgess for being our guest today on Cowtown Conversations, and also Leslie. But we never end Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. School ends next Tuesday in the Kansas City PS, and summer school starts on May the 30th. So if you'd like to get information about summer school, contact the KCPS at 816-418-7000. Also, Cornerstones of Care will be hosting a weekly healthy relationships class starting next Wednesday, May the 30th. For more information, give them a call at 844 844- 824-8200. And the Kansas City Police Department is recruiting youth from ages 12 to 15 for the Youth Academy at East Patrol, which is located at 2640 Prospect Avenue. And the dates for that is going to start June the 11th through Friday, June the 15th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. each day. To enroll, please give them a call at 816-234-5404. Join us next Thursday, May 31st, as we discuss Kansas City Public Schools Board of Governors redistricting process. And tune in to hear how it will affect you and your family. For Cowtown Conversations, this is your host, Joseph Jackson. Have a great day and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.